The Beat Podcast is brought to you by Nutritia and is designed for healthcare professionals only. In this mini-series, we have partnered with Feel Good, human health and performance experts who transform science into practical, real-life solutions. You will hear from experts in psychology, nutrition, mental health, sleep, movement, and more. This podcast is all about you, whether that be on your lunch break, on your commute, or simply when you need to get moving. Take a moment for yourself and learn on the move.
In this podcast, we will unpack the topic of compassion fatigue, explain what it is, why it occurs, and help you recognize your own risk factors. We will share ideas and strategies for how to maintain your own personal well-being and the ability to care for others while maintaining it over time. Our guest today is Dr. Philippa Spencer. Philippa is a chartered psychologist with over 20 years of experience working with the NHS and private clients. She has a special interest in supporting clients overcome burnout and compassion fatigue and has delivered training for leading UK private and public firms. Philippa, welcome today. Before we start, I'd like to ask you, why is actually compassion fatigue and also burnout, why are they some of your key areas of interest?
Well, thank you for asking me that question. Mainly because they matter so much. I have spent the last 20 years working in various sectors with different teams. And I think through that experience, what I've seen, sadly, is often these incredible professionals, often in these caring roles, doing really challenging jobs. And what I have seen over those years is many of those people losing the ability to work in the way that they ideally would. In the worst case scenarios, I've seen people having to leave their professions because they have been so affected by either compassion fatigue, burnout, or perhaps even both at the same time. And these people really matter to us. You know, we live in a time that we actually need people doing these incredibly important jobs. So that's where my interest comes from. And I've had the great privilege of working with all sorts of people and teams, helping them think about these topics, helping them to better understand it and think about how they can keep themselves well and they can make sure they can flourish despite the fact there are a lot of pressures around. So I guess that's where it comes from. This stuff really matters to me. So I'm delighted to have the chance to talk about this with you.
Amazing. It is indeed such an important topic. And before we dive in, can we take a step back and look at what is compassion?
Yeah, so great question. So I could offer you a dry textbook definition, but I'm not going to do that today. Instead, what I'm going to invite you to do is to just take a moment to bring to mind perhaps the image of, let's say, a more elderly person sitting on their own in a room. So you've just come across them. And you see them sitting there and they're looking really sad. They're perhaps having a little weep on their own. And I'm going to invite you to just notice what feeling shows up for you. Now, I can't know how anyone is feeling, but I'm going to hazard a guess that for many people imagining that situation, compassion has shown up. And compassion is really all about feeling something of that person's distress and critically wanting to do something to alleviate it. And I'd also invite you to just pause and consider how remarkable that is. You know, our ability to feel compassion for people we don't know, that we will never even meet, even just imagining somebody in that situation, it can evoke feelings of compassion. I find that absolutely a remarkable part of being a human being. So that's what compassion is. That's how I think about it. And I hope that gives a good explanation.
Yes, definitely. And yeah, it's so amazing how we feel this even just by thinking about this person. And I guess as professionals, it's often time you also take those patients may be with you at home. So it's not, you don't just feel it in the moment, but it's a feeling that can easily stay with you. So in this context, what is compassion fatigue and what are the risk factors? So why some people may develop it while others not?
Yeah, so good question. So compassion fatigue, I guess, in essence, is about the gradual wearing down of our ability to feel what I've just described. So, you know, we no longer feel able to care about or for other people. And so just before we kind of dig into that, I think it's just really important to say that, you know, feeling compassion, being able to feel compassion is really important because it's kind of an inbuilt instinct that we've got. Even very young children, we know from research, you know, they are born with a natural tendency to want to show compassion to other people. And its basis is evolutionary, as are most things. And when we feel compassionate towards other people, it improves our social connections. And in many thousands of years ago, that would have been very important for our place in the tribe or the group. And when we show compassion to other people, you know, it's not just the other person who benefits. We ourselves experience this increase in some really important hormones, so namely oxytocin and serotonin. So they create that warm glow that we experience when we've shown kindness. So we actually get this neurochemical reward for being compassionate, and long term that improves both our mental and physical health. So actually it's a near perfect design. In many ways it's win-win, and we don't have many of those in life. So actually one of the reasons compassion fatigue is, you know, so problematic is that we are in essence losing this critical ability that makes us very much part of what it is to be a human being. So to lose that, I often think, is a bit like losing one of our, you know, our key abilities. Perhaps not as significant as perhaps losing our sight or hearing, but I think it's really, really difficult if we lose that critical ability to feel compassion.
So does that mean also, like, in a way we lose that increased oxytocin and serotonin and that feeling of the warm glow that you mentioned that we would normally get from helping someone once we're maybe exposed to people who need our compassion more than we would maybe a million years ago or something like that? Is that what you mean?
Exactly. So we no longer have that capacity. We've lost that ability to care about other people. And so we don't get any of the benefits, you know, of those kind of those feel good hormones that help us in terms of mental.
Yeah. So why does that happen? And yeah, what are the risk factors?
Yeah. So in terms of what causes this, it's fundamentally caused by being exposed to other people's suffering or distress, and that can be direct or indirect. So you can see somebody else's suffering firsthand, or you can just read or hear about it. And that means that we see compassion fatigue in a really wide range of professions. So most commonly people associate it with those working in health and social care settings, and that's absolutely right. So compassion fatigue is definitely seen in that area. But, you know, we see it in people in the police force, we see it in criminal lawyers, we see it in prison staff, journalists who are covering, you know, traumatic content, teachers, and also those in the background, so administrators and receptionists who are just being exposed to people's distress.
And I guess maybe to the ones who are watching news way too often, or to whom maybe their filters on social media have been, caught one of those algorithms that only show you, I don't know, people suffering or problems and challenges around.
It's such a good point, Andrea, because, you know, the last few years, I think what we've all been exposed to is some very difficult content. And, you know, there are so many challenges in the world that mean, yes, there is a lot of news items that exposes us to other people's suffering. So you're absolutely right. In many ways, everyone is vulnerable to this, most certainly. I think it's important to say, though, that compassion fatigue is really rarely caused by one incident or story, but it's about all of the stories that people are exposed to over time. And many of those they may not even remember, but they kind of absorb them and they carry them with them. So this is something that happens over time.
So how can we identify that in us? And how can we make the difference between, for example, compassion fatigue and burnout? Because I know you mentioned burnout at the start as well.
Yeah, certainly. So let's start with the kind of symptoms of compassion fatigue, how it looks, you know, what we might see in somebody. And then we'll come on to talk about the difference between that and burnout. So with compassion fatigue, we have this pretty broad symptom set. It can show up as physical, emotional, behavioural, cognitive, interpersonal, spiritual symptoms. So it's a really broad symptom set. But I would say that there are two key characteristics of compassion fatigue. The first is exhaustion, and that's mental and physical exhaustion. But the second is this whole thing about an altered worldview. So what we see happening to people is that they develop this very uncharacteristically negative outlook. They may well become overly critical. They may start making generalizations. They may become argumentative. And then what we see happening is this development of a disdain for other people. So they become indifferent. They become quite disengaged. We might see them avoiding other people or mocking other people. And ultimately what it can lead to is something called depersonalization. And that means that they start to almost not view other people in a particularly kind of humane way. So that's where we might see the emergence of cruelty and or neglect.
Is it is fatigue the one that comes first, or can it, or can they come at the same time? So I'm thinking, for example, if you are at a stage where you still care for others, you're not dehumanizing, but you're just tired and drained by everyone and so fatigued. Does it mean that unless you're taking some action now, the next step it's going to be that distancing yourself and becoming maybe more cynical, or not necessarily?
Yeah, I think there is a trajectory, that there is a path that people seem to tread. And I think exhaustion is often that kind of first red flag. Mm-hmm. So people really feeling, it's like that deep fatigue. This is not the stuff that's solved by a good night's sleep. So I think definitely that's the red flag. And I think that altered worldview is further down the path. And certainly that state of depersonalization, that's really right at the kind of end of the trajectory. So I wouldn't want people to feel worried that that's going to show up quickly. That's much further down the line.
Amazing. And what's then the difference between this and burnout?
Yeah, so I get asked this question lots and lots. There's a big overlap. So they share many of the same symptoms, but they are different things. And the best way I can explain it is that burnout is reactional. So it's a reaction to workplace stress. So anyone in any job can suffer from burnout. Compassion fatigue is relational. So this is about other people, and it's the consequence of being exposed to their distress. So it really does only affect those whose role involves some sort of exposure, whether that's direct or indirect. So definitely some similar symptoms, but different causes. And I would say that depersonalization, that kind of disdain for other people, that's probably a critical difference in terms of symptoms. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've ever kind of met someone who's really burnt out that talks in terms of depersonalization.
So what I'd be very curious to do now is to maybe dive into some of your examples and patients that you worked with that had compassion fatigue and that had different symptoms. And if you could walk us through how they managed to overcome those. So, for example, someone who was at that first level and they just started feeling very fatigued and tired and the one night sleep wouldn't help. What did you recommend there, or what can be done before things escalate?
So I think in a way, the answer to that question lies in understanding our risk factors. So would it feel okay, Andrea, if we covered off those risk factors first? Because I think that really kind of adds important information for us. So because I've talked about exposure being a key risk factor, but there are actually other ones. So what I'd invite people to do is really just think about this as a set of scales that look a bit like a seesaw. So those kind of simple scales, and you've got ingredients at either end of them. And depending on sort of how much of each of these ingredients we have at any given time will tip us in the direction of compassion fatigue or actually guard against it. So let's just have a quick look at those. In terms of the risk factors for compassion fatigue, they're grouped into three areas. Amount of exposure, I've talked about that, but particularly when solutions are limited. So we're exposed to somebody's distress and we feel helpless to solve it. That's one. The second risk factor is all about empathy. So that's this lovely and magic ingredient in human communication. You know, that ability to see the world from someone else's perspective and step into their shoes, albeit briefly. Now, being empathic is a key skill in many professions. It's certainly in healthcare, it makes for better patient care and better patient outcomes. But the greater your empathy, the greater the risk of compassion fatigue. The third risk factor, work and life pressures. So your workload, your long hours, you know, the bureaucracy, office politics, perhaps working in isolation or feeling unsupported, perhaps being asked to do things that are beyond your skill level. So all of those work pressures and then family stresses, relationships, childcare, money worries, that all sits on that side of the scales. On the other end, we have the protective factors. And we've got two main ones that sit there. And the first protective factor is job satisfaction. All the great stuff about work, making a difference, helping others, feeling part of a great team, having that sense of value and meaning, learning new things, developing particular expertise. So that's one protective factor. And the other, you probably won't be surprised to hear, is personal resilience. So the more resilient you are, the more job satisfaction you're likely to experience, and the less likely you are to succumb to organisational and personal pressure. So actually resilience is a double whammy of protection against compassion fatigue. So if the risks outweigh the protective factors, our chances of compassion fatigue increase, and if our protective factors outweigh the risks, that offers us some protection.
So, for example, if you're someone who has quite a lot of empathy, it's exposed to people's distress, and maybe lately you haven't had a lot of work-life balance, and there's been a lot of pressure coming from deadlines, maybe feeling unsupported. So that would automatically make you feel that tiredness, fatigue, and in time lead to that depersonalization. Whereas if in all of this, you actually have a good team, you feel valued, you have this sense of purpose, and you're also building your personal resilience, actually all those factors don't have the same impact on you anymore and don't feel as tired maybe at the end of the day. Is that what you're saying?
You're absolutely right. Yeah, it's about watching that balance between risk factors and protective factors. Because that balance will be shifting all of the time, depending on what's going on. But yes, absolutely, that's exactly what.
So then, can we have a look at these two protective factors? So, job satisfaction and personal resilience. What can we do very practically in our day-to-day lives to increase this?
Yeah, great. So I think if we feel the balance is going off. If we need to keep checking the balance, you know, that's the first thing we need to do. Just be aware of what on earth's going on. Often that's easier said than done because anything can become normal. But, you know, regularly check in with yourself and your colleagues, you know, ask them, which way are your scales tipping? Really just keep that conversation going, because the good news is that if the balance is going off, there's lots that we can do. Now, in terms of what we can do about this, we're all different. So one size definitely doesn't fit all. Each of us needs to have a really good think about, firstly, what's going on in our working lives and our personal lives, and then think about what needs to change and how we're going to do that. And I would always say that the place to start, if you feel the balance is tipping the wrong way, is think about whether there are any organisational solutions. You know, if your job satisfaction is low, you know, my question there would be, what is causing that? And can it be remedied? Is there an organisational solution here? is there something practical that can be done? Because very often, you know, low job satisfaction is caused by things like, you know, shift patterns, just an unrealistic workload, deadlines, they're not being backfill if you want to perhaps go and do some professional development. So you feel that sense of frustration. Maybe you haven't got the equipment that you need to do your job properly. Is the office environment just not conducive to work? You know, is there anything going on organisationally that there is a more simple solution to? So if yes, you think there is an organisational issue, I think the first thing I'd say is speak to your manager, speak to your colleagues, see if there's something you can do to remedy that. That's the first place I would go.
Yes.
Sadly, that's not always possible. It's not always possible to solve things in that way. And if that's the case, what we need to do is look at our personal strategy. So we need to look at ourselves. And I think about that a bit as, you know, looking in the mirror, having a good look at ourselves. What can we do to build our personal resilience, you know, create that buffer for ourselves? There are lots and lots of ways of doing that. You know, there are lots of choices here in terms of how we build resilience, from developing a more resilient mindset, firming up and certainly activating boundaries, you know, learning to identify and regulate our emotional responses, thinking about our kind of self-confidence, our self-efficacy, really making sure we are focusing on recovery and self-care. And I guess finding really good sources of support, whether that's our colleagues or something more formal in terms of supervision, so that we can process our work and process the impact it has on us so that they don't become negative in their impacts on us.
Exactly. So I think what you're saying there is the first step is take a moment to create a little bit of that space so you can make the changes in the areas that you can have control over. Because otherwise, we're just going to spend all our time thinking and ruminating over what we can't control. And that's going to add to that fatigue, add to all that feeling of being drained. So take some space. First, have a look at what can you change in your job. And you didn't mention the organizational things, but also the team-related aspects. Oftentimes, it's the people that give us energy. So feeling valued by our colleagues can make such a big difference. So in this context, it's also our responsibility to think about how can we support our colleagues to help improve their job satisfaction. And then it's also thinking about these personal strategies. And here is where I would like to spend a little bit more time, because we all know in theory, you know, what we should do. We all know, yes, from a physical perspective, we should eat well, exercise, and take care of our bodies. And then from a mindset perspective, have a growth mindset. But oftentimes, especially if you reach that second stage of depersonalization, in a way, that fatigue and that cynicism takes over. So what are some practical things we can do that you found that work with your clients when you know the theory, but in practice, you're just too tired to apply it?
Goodness, that's such a good question, because, you know, one of the ultimate challenges here is that when we feel really tired, when we feel really exhausted, it can be very, very difficult to take action, positive action.
Exactly.
And, you know, we struggle to care for ourselves in the best of times. And actually, when we're feeling really tired, that becomes even more challenging. I think for each person, it's going to be different. I would say that we need to really look at the importance of maintaining our well-being, because, you know, if we go further down that trajectory, it will become more and more difficult to do our jobs. It will become more and more difficult to have positive interpersonal relationships, both within our work setting and our family setting. There's a lot at stake here. So I would gently invite people just to consider the consequences here of not doing something. And I don't say that in any way to frighten people. It's to try to help people understand that we can turn this round. There's lots that we can do, and often it doesn't take major intervention. They can be quite small steps, but I would really encourage people to think about that broader context. We don't want to go down this path. You know, we want people to stay well. We want people to be able to stick with their jobs. So that's really important.
Yes, of course.
I always start with, I don't know why it feels so important to me, but I always start with the issue of boundaries, because they're not so much a resilience strategy. They're more a kind of underpinning. You know, if we have a foundation that is all about good, strong boundaries, it makes it much, much easier then to put into place those everyday resilience skills. So I guess that's maybe why I always start there. So I think boundaries are just absolutely critical in the context of compassion fatigue, because they do two things. They protect us from all the risk factors I mentioned, but they also help to increase job satisfaction. So they're very powerful. There's always a challenge with boundaries, because in many of these more caring professions, you know, whatever somebody is doing, you know, actually we want to be empathic, but we want to do it in a way that we don't lose ourselves, that we don't become overwhelmed with other people's stories. So actually what we need to do is to find ways of maintaining a sense of ourselves in order to protect our well-being.
So can you give us a few examples on how we can maintain these boundaries during
hours? So thank you for raising that, because a lot of people think it's boundaries are just the line between work and home. And yes, that's incredibly important. But actually, there are things we can do through a working day to just reinforce and activate boundaries all the time. So I'll just give you some examples of things I know people do, and certainly some of the things that I would recommend people do. So through the course of a working day, particularly if you're having a lot of exposure to, you know, people in distress, or, you know, certainly problems that you're struggling to solve, take regular opportunities to remind yourself of who you are. So don't get pulled into other people's stories. Ground yourself. And I would recommend things like, take a few moments just to, you know, we all carry smartphones with us full of photographs that remind us of our lives outside work. Mm-hmm. Take a few moments to look at a photograph of, you know, your partner, your kids, your pet dog, maybe something you've been working on, a project. Ground yourself. Remind yourself of who you are, that you're more than this role. Some people use personal items, you know, if you're perhaps someone who is married and wears a wedding band, you know, just feel that on your finger. Remind yourself of those relationships in your life. You know, you're more than this. So that's a really nice strategy. I would always say, think very carefully about managing your self-disclosures when you're working with patients or clients. You know, don't get tempted to tell them stories about yourselves. Keep the focus on them. Don't get drawn into those self-disclosure moments. If you're having a lot of contacts in a day, try to make sure that there's a gap, even if it's a tiny one, between each contact. I know some people will listen to a song, you know, something upbeat. Some people might do a bit of breathing. Some people might just run up and down a few flights of stairs. Try to create some sort of gap between contacts so you can, in a way, debrief off the previous contact before you go to the next one.
Yeah, and I heard one of my colleagues was telling me recently that there is some new research saying that even just a few minutes, even seconds of taking a few seconds and just breathing can have a very physical impact on your brain. So you can actually see the changes in a scan afterwards, just creating that space in your day, not being constantly always on, and just giving yourself a little bit of time to get back to yourself, to what you're feeling, what you're thinking.
Absolutely. You know, I'm so there for that. I think it's a really useful strategy. It's not going to work for everyone, but I know a lot of people who do that. I think there's also, you know, trying to stick to time. Time is always, there's never enough time, but, you know, really looking at when people start and finish work, the time boundaries that they put around interactions with patients or clients, you know, stick to that time, and really do your best to take your breaks, you know, time to just eat, so you're not eating and walking. So during work hours, there are things we can do. All of those things are about boundaries, keeping ourselves steady and safe during the working day.
And I guess the key one, learning to say no gracefully. Maybe just saying something like, I'm afraid that's not possible for me right now, because X, Y, and Z, and just learning how to phrase that no in a graceful way.
Yeah, I love that. So such an important thing. It's the ultimate boundary, isn't it? The no, and a lot of us struggle with that. Absolutely key life skill, and it doesn't need to be said negatively. It can be said with grace, and that's something I guess all of us can practice.
Exactly. So I found these very practical things very useful. Do you have something similar about how do we develop that resilient mindset? Because resilience has been around for a long time, but it doesn't mean that we all conquered it, and it's something that we're constantly working on. So do you have any practical, maybe words that we can tell to ourselves to help build resilient thoughts or actions to build that resilient mindset?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's very easy when we're in situations where other people are needing things from us, or we're feeling distressed, or we've got all of these problems we need to solve. It's very easy to fall into ways of thinking that aren't particularly resilient. Very commonly people kind of find themselves saying to themselves, I've got to sort this out. If I don't do it, then I failed. I've got to make this okay. This poor person, I can't let them down. And it's very understandable why we might kind of fall into that train of thinking. As human beings, we want to help others. And if you're in a caring profession, it's part of your job. So I completely understand why that happens. But the truth is, those kind of thoughts are firstly not realistic, and they will set us up to fail. So what we need to do is think about a kind of more resilient set of thoughts. Mm-hmm. And the sorts of things I'm talking about here are, so I'm going to run through some. These are the sorts of thoughts that sometimes I use for myself, or I have suggested other people might just have up their sleeve. So in those moments when you find yourself thinking, I've got to solve all of this, this is terrible, it's all my fault, the sorts of sort of self-talk. I feel stress, but I can still deal with this. That's a resilient thought. It's okay for me to think slowly about what I need to do next. That's a more resilient thought. This doesn't feel pleasant, but I can accept it. That's a resilient thought. And then things like this situation will pass. Nothing stays the same for long.
Yeah.
So these kind of steadying thoughts, they ground us. They take some of that pressure away. They allow us to do our work, but to do it in a way that we're just not beating ourselves up and becoming brittle in the process.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's something about that idea that you just mentioned now, not beating ourselves up, which has been especially relevant and important for me. For example, some of the thoughts I was thinking to choose more consciously recently have been, it doesn't have to be hard. It can be easy. Like, suffering is not required in this. I can make this easier if I just let go, if I just don't worry that much. So it can be easy. That was one of my winners. And also another thing that worked for me, that I'm very curious to see your perspective on this, is something along the fact permission is not required. I feel like I was waiting for permission from someone else to not care anymore, permission to put that boundary, permission to do something for myself, maybe, I don't know, for my family. But actually, permission is not required. You can just do what you need to do, and things can be easy. And just focusing on those few things for a few months, I've noticed I managed to let go of quite a lot of stress and fatigueness. So I was curious about your perspective on this too.
Yeah, that's so interesting. There's something definitely in what you're saying, just about recognising that You know, we can do these things for ourselves, that we are responsible for ourselves. But there's a freedom in that. I think one of the things I observe is, particularly in certain teams and in certain professions, there's a lot of hierarchy, you know, based on experience. And when we've got a lot of experience, we're in more senior jobs. And I think there's a lot of kind of issues for more junior staff about needing permission and waiting to be told if what's okay and what isn't. And I understand why that happens. And of course, that means that there's a very important role for managers and leaders. We might get onto that if we have time. But I think your message is a really important one, that all of us are responsible for ourselves. This is our well-being. And yes, there's all sorts of permissions we can give ourselves. Yeah. That doesn't mean that we won't do a good job. It just means we're also prioritising what we need as well. And that's essential, absolutely essential. So yeah, thank you for raising that. I'm glad that that worked for you.
Yeah, it's very interesting how if you just make a decision that you're going to stop, I don't know, thinking something, doing something, and just going to change the narrative that you have for your life, things can change.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I have another question before we dive into a set of like quick fire questions, because I know we've been talking for quite a lot. But in your experience, what has been the biggest difference between those who have recovered, got better, got their energy back, got their compassion back without feeling that cynicism, versus the ones who didn't?
Great question. And really important to emphasize that people do get better. Yes. You know, this isn't a permanent state. It's going to take some tweaks and changes, but people do get better. I would say that the key thing I notice in people who kind of transition back into feeling good, and those who might take longer or struggle to, it all lies in self-awareness. So firstly, knowing how we're feeling and investing in self-care, that's one part of it. But there's actually another dimension to it. And so please bear with me, because it's a little bit kind of deeper, a bit more psychological. It's really being prepared to be aware of why we choose to do this kind of work. Mm. You know, asking ourselves what draws us to want to work in perhaps a helping or caring profession. And the reason that's so important is because we all bring stuff with us into these jobs in terms of our personal needs and our personality type that can certainly exacerbate our vulnerability to compassion fatigue. So let me kind of make this a bit more accessible. So for example, if the reason I'm drawn to work as a psychologist is because I need to feel useful, or because I need to, let's say, feel a sense of authority, or because I need it for my own self-esteem, you know, I risk being driven by that need rather than what's best for me or my patients. Now, everybody has needs. There's nothing wrong with them. They're not harmful. But if we aren't aware of them, then they can actually turn into demands, and demands require fulfillment. So they end up driving us, and that makes it much harder to look after ourselves. So being aware of all of that stuff for me is critical. And some people find that easier to face into than others. But if you have the courage to ask yourself the question, why do I do this job, and answer it honestly, then I think that's a really, really big step in this. We also need to be aware of our personality type. You know, because there are some personality types that can make us a bit more vulnerable, a bit more frail. So if I'm somebody who's very high in emotionality, if I'm very prone to worrying, then I need to find strategies for dealing with that. If I'm introverted, then, you know, how do I make sure that after a long week of patient contacts and I get enough time to recharge? Or if I have perfectionistic tendencies, as lots of people do, and I find myself in an environment that it is just not possible to spend lots of time on each task, then how am I going to manage that? You know, knowing who we are, why we do this work, it's essential, because it means we know what we need to focus on in terms of our self-care, because it's going to look different for everybody.
Exactly. And is it... how easy is it to change something that's part of your personality? So if you're that perfectionist who wants to give the best in everything, and that ends up draining you, and then at the end of the day, you feel like you're not doing a good job, and then you're in that negative cycle. Because as far as I know, personality is quite set in stone. So How much can we do?
Well, the way I think about this is, so I'm 5'3", and there's always going to be, you know, I'm never going to be able to change that. But there are all sorts of things that I can do to ensure that I still kind of maximise my physicality, how much I can achieve. So there's all sorts of things that I can put in place to make sure that that doesn't restrict me or limit my life. So it's just kind of in a way the same with these personality factors. So if I am very introverted, I can't change that. You know, that's who I am. That's part of my fabric. But there's all sorts of things I can do to ensure that that doesn't become a damaging factor for me. So it's about just being honest about who we are, what we are, and then putting things in place to accommodate that. Maybe perfectionism is slightly different because I think there's probably things we can do to reduce that. There are things that sit underneath that that we can probably tackle. Yeah. But ultimately, I'm not in the job of changing people. I'm in the job of helping people think about, you know, what can we do in order to flourish, in order to stay well? What can we do in order to make sure we do our jobs to the best of our ability without harming ourselves?
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah, maybe, yeah, definitely perfectionism may not be the best example for me to bring up because we know it's, you have healthy perfectionism, you have maladaptive perfectionism, and there are so many different aspects and characteristics that play into that. Oh, I feel like there are so many like very good tips here. Should we go into a set of quick fire questions? So you have about 30 seconds, maybe maximum 1 minute to reply for to any question from now on. So we can touch a little bit more ground in the shortest amount of time that we can.
I'll have a go.
So let's say if you're in a more senior or managerial position, what can you do to support your team?
Remember that whatever you do, your team will do too. So are you a good role model? Do you lead by example? Discrepancies make people anxious. If you're telling people to go home on time and you don't do it yourself, you either need to speak directly to that or you need to role model what you want them to do. That is absolutely critical. Managers have an incredibly important role in reducing compassion fatigue and burnout.
Thank you very much. And then how long does it take to recover?
Yeah, that's a bit like how long is a piece of string. It depends how far down the trajectory somebody is. I think this is something that, so long as people spot it early enough, usually with a few small tweaks and changes, this is something that can be turned around. If somebody has reached a point of feeling that, you know, they're in a state of depersonalization, it's going to take longer, but it doesn't mean it can't happen. I think if someone is really, really far down the line, I'd really suggest that they perhaps get some professional support just to help them really unpack what's gone on here and how they can turn things around. But anybody can come back from this.
Yeah, and then can people still recover while still being good at their job?
Again, that would really depend on how far down the path they are. If somebody is, you know, feeling that they just can't stand being near patients, if they feel disdain for them, if they can't look after them, it may be they need to take some time off in order to turn things around a bit. But that's not always the case. I think that's back to this issue of self-awareness. If we know it's happening, it means we can sort it out.
Yeah, and the last two questions, I know you won't like them because I know what the tips for this differ depending on the person, but what is, if you had to choose one exercise out of everything we discussed, one quick exercise that people can do when they feel that tiredness that comes with compassion fatigue, what they can do in that situation?
I think for me, the thing I do in that situation is I ground myself, I remember I'm more than this role, I think about other things in my life that matter to me, and I think about how I'm going to kind of invest in those and focus in those.
Thank you. And then what's the quickest exercise someone can do if they feel that cynicism that comes with compassion fatigue?
I would take that as a red flag and a sign that I need to do something. I really need to do something about this. I may not be able to remedy it in that moment, but I need to make a commitment to think about how I'm going to ensure I can get that feeling back, that feeling of caring about people.
Yeah, so definitely it's something we haven't touched too much. I mean, we touched a little bit on this, but not too much. And I was planning to finish here, but I have one last question, actually. If you're with the patient and you're feeling that cynicism and resentment for them as well, and that negativity, is there anything you can do in the moment to kind of bring back to yourself in order to give them that compassion that you would like to give them?
I think in order to do that, we're going to have to dig really deep in order to offer really good patient care. But again, I would be listening to that as a red flag. You know, I'd make it to the end of that appointment, doing my very, very best, and then I'd need to take action, because that's not a great place to be if that's how we're feeling.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not great for ourselves, for others. Coming back to what we mentioned before, it gives us a sense of joy, a sense of satisfaction when we are able to feel this compassion in a positive way. So thank you very, very much, Filipa. Is there any other final thought, idea, tip that you'd like to leave the audience with?
No other than, you know, please look after yourselves, please look after each other. We're all kind of in this together. You touched on the importance of team. If you're in a team, keep an eye on each other, be kind to each other. And, you know, if we see any of that kind of behaviour that's not altogether helpful, then, you know, let's just deal with that, think positively, be kind, be supportive. You know, I think that goes a long way to building that job satisfaction and giving people that sense of meaning and purpose at work.
Exactly. It may sound a little bit paradoxical, and correct me if it actually is, but I'm thinking, for me, sometimes, yeah, what helps is do the opposite. Think about how small I am and then how small my worries and my drains are in comparison with everything that's happening in the world. So by focusing on others, as you mentioned here, or maybe my colleagues, supporting someone else, can it actually help reduce compassion fatigue?
So that's interesting. That's a strategy called positive comparison. It's certainly been known to be helpful for people to focus on bigger world issues, to put into perspective their own. I don't think there's been any research done in the context of compassion fatigue, but listen, if it works and it makes people feel calmer and better and more able to cope, then I say have a go.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much, and thank you everyone for listening. I hope you all managed to get at least something practical or some thoughts for you to think about for the rest of the day. And if you like this podcast, please do share it with your colleagues, with your friends, families, and have a wonderful day ahead. Or evening.
To keep up to date with future episodes of the Beat podcast from Nutritia, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. For more updates on the show, as well as lots of other educational content from Nutritia, sign up to our newsletter at www.nutritia.co.uk.